limits here. Down exactly 10 dB. Night bulb to it, gentlemen. Thank you. original cap or a flat. Thank you.
hold.
So we've kind of got a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But the interesting aspect of this, at least to me, is that basically it's sort of the same exact thing going on in both of these cases. And what's going on is when you have the bottle and it's closed tightly, you're in an equilibrium position. The pressure of the air above the soda is maintained at about 4 atmosphere. There is a large amount of carbon dioxide that's forced into solution because of the high pressure, and it maintains an equilibrium that allows supermarkets to store soda for a month. If you violate the equilibrium, if you open the spout, gas will come out of it. Certainly the 3 atmospheres of gas at the very top will go out of it. And then slowly over time, as we all know, the carbon dioxide will escape from the soda and you'll get flat soda. But although this is a disequilibrium reaction, it's a very slow one. It doesn't happen immediately. So the point is that with the other two examples, you're speeding up the equalization of the pressures of the dissolved gases. And you do that by introducing, I think Wes mentioned it, nucleation bodies. If you put little teeny bubbles mixed in with the soda by shaking it up, those small nucleation sites will grow enormously big with carbon dioxide from the dissolved solution and project everything out the top when you open it. If you knock the little bubbles away and have them break up before you open the cap, it won't do that. So you have to have the little bubbles as nucleating bodies. With Mentos, the Mentos themselves are nucleating bodies. They don't have any chemical reaction. If you had something made out of carbon or glass or what have you that was the same irregular shape, you would have the same exact reaction going on. It's the irregularity of the nucleating bodies that increase the rate of the equilibrium reaction and cause all that foam to pour out. So the answer is, if you cap the bottle and you shake it, the pressure remains the same. And if you throw the Mentos in, the pressure remains the same.
There have been people who took a can of beer, Roy, and shook it violently. And the can begins to bulge. And if you then open the can, it comes squirting out of there. That would lead you to believe that a can of beer goes to higher pressure internally when you shake it. If beer can do that, I think soda can also do that. Over to you, Roy, KQRIW.
Well, I don't know. I'll leave the link. It's a Veritasium YouTube. You like watching Mueller's work as well. And he actually has the pressure device. And, you know, I mean, there might be a slight fluctuation. There might be something that goes on with the when you shake it, you mix the air and the beer, so it forms little bubble-like things, so it might change a little bit of the quality, but ultimately, the pressures don't really change, or at least that you could measure with a manometer. Now, it's not bad that people who said that the pressure increases, because he even cites an article in a scientific magazine back from, I think it was 1986, in which they say that the pressure does increase, even though it doesn't. Because right after they published that story, there were a lot of letters to the editor yelling and screaming at those guys. So although I would agree with you, it seems like it makes sense that the pressure increases. It apparently doesn't. The pressure is really related to both the volume of the air gap and the temperature. And, CV equal NRT, boiled point. So since it's not changing the volume of the air, and it's not changing the temperature much of the gas, it doesn't change the pressure of the gas.
Let's see the word. So, because the soda is on constant of waterless volume, and when you take the soda, that dissolves you to in escape the liquid and becomes additional free gas in that space. So since Boyle's law shows that pressure X, volume is constant, if you increase the number of free CO2 molecules in the head space without making the space bigger, the pressure mass goes up. Intuition.
Well, if everything that you said was true, yes, it would. But shaking up the bottle is not going to release any of the dissolved gases in a closed system. It's in an equilibrium condition, and simply agitating it is not going to cause the one atom of carbon dioxide to go from dissolved into the soda into the air.
I must agree. Intuition.
Is 4 atmospheres, Roy, just an average amount of carbonization? You know what I mean. If I put the seltzer water, so to speak, under 10 atmospheres of pressure and bubbled CO2 through it, could I then have a bottle of soda that would show higher than 4 atmospheres? Over to you, Roy, K2RIW.
Yes, you could. You would need stronger containment than the soda industry is willing to. Pressures of carbon dioxide.
Okay. When I shake the bottle, say for instance I take the cap off, put my thumb over the top and shake the bottle. Are you saying that underneath my thumb it would not go above 4 atmospheres? Over you, Roy.
I would say that unless you have a fairly bizarre looking thumb, you can't maintain a pressure seal, and what will inevitably happen is the 4 atmospheres of gas is going to start to escape around the edges of your thumb, and then the nucleated soda is going to liberate more carbon dioxide, and the whole thing will get all over the place.
Okay, after I've opened the cap and I shake it, what about the shaking, the agitation, makes more of the carbon dioxide come out of solution?
What you're doing is you're introducing the gas layer as a... You're dispersing the gaseous carbon dioxide as small bubbles throughout the solution. The bubbles in the solution are our nucleating bodies from whence a lot of the dissolved carbon dioxide, it's much easier and it's a faster rate of transition. It'll just make those little bubbles grow into big bubbles, and they'll rise up and they'll take some of the soda along with them, and they'll fly out the top of the bottle.
I think the important thing is that we're dealing with a closed system. By that, Dr. Roy is right.
If I started off by opening the bottle and pouring more soda into it, there's no airspace left, and now I put my thumb over it and shake it, are you saying I'm not going to build up pressure under those conditions because there isn't an airspace to do further mixing? Over to you, Roy.
Just for the sake of my own obsessive compulsiveness, let's change that a little bit. Let's fill it and replace either a regular cap or the cap with a manometer, and then shake it up. And then after it settles for a minute or two, take the top off. I think because of what I just said about nucleation, there wouldn't be any significant nucleation. So if it was a completely filled container with no air fluid layer whatsoever. You would have no nucleation. You have would have no explosive fizz.
Okay, if the bottle is only half full before I do the shaking operation, do I get a greater amount of action?
You get more nucleation, but you have less of the solution of dissolved carbon dioxide. So you have two opposite things going on, and how exactly that would settle off. My sense would be that it would probably be a less violent reaction just because you're dealing with half the volume of a liquid with a gas dissolved in it in a disequilibrium condition.
Well, I earlier described shaking up a can of beer. If a can of beer had no airspace in it and I shook it, are you saying I wouldn't build up any extra pressure in that can of beer? The sides wouldn't be bulging, is what you're saying. It's only the airspace that creates that condition?
That's the way it was explained to me. The problem, again, is that it's probably not very easy to accomplish something like that. You inevitably have some kind of air gap inside there. But yeah, that's the way it sounds from the explanation that I've heard.
So the carbon dioxide doesn't come out of solution because of agitation. It's coming out because of a mixture of air bubbles into the fluid that act as nucleation sites, is what I think you're saying.
That's exactly. It's all nucleation of something that's supersaturated. The same way that we talked in the past, that if you very, very, very slowly cool distilled water in a somewhat perfect environment, you could take it out of the freezer and it would be perfectly liquid, and you could just tap it on the table, and because it's super cool, it will spontaneously, just from that agitation, nucleation will occur, and it will crystallize into a solid piece of ice. So the mechanism is nucleation and a disequilibrium condition. When you open the bottle, there's disequilibrium, but it's slow to equilibrate. If you add more nucleation bodies, the rate increases in some ways explosively.
If I did it very carefully, what's the lowest temperature I could get a bottle of water at without it turning into a solid? Could I get it to minus 15 centigrade?
I don't really know how low you can super cool distilled water. It would be interesting to look that up. I think you can't really get it too far below. So, and that we're talking, of course, at one atmosphere, because things do different things at different pressures, as we've talked about phase diagrams and such. But I don't know exactly. It would be interesting to see if anyone actually has done the study of exactly how low you can bring something like distilled water and still have it stay in the liquid phase.
The fact that I can take a whole bottle of liquid that has been super cooled and turn all of it into a solid, and the heat of fusion there is 80 calories per gram. In other words, each gram of water, as it goes from the liquid state to the solid state, there's a change of 80 calories. In order for all of that water to turn solid, boy, there's got to be a lot of delta temperature there to make up the 80 calories, if you see what I'm saying. WRKQIW.
I could understand. It does require transition of thermal energy, but again, there's lots of YouTubes about it. I don't think I've ever actually taken the time and trouble. I don't really have any kind of readily available source of distilled water, so it's much more difficult to do it with regular tap water.
And here's the question, Roy. I've got this bottle of super-cooled water. I very carefully put a thermometer into it. I then agitate it so it turns into a solid. Does the thermometer move?
Well, to zoom, it goes up in temperature. It started out as something like minus 5 degrees centigrade or something, but probably when it's done, it probably goes up. Just not enough to be the melting point.
VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
As the supercooled water, as it freezes, isn't there an interval where water and ice is coexisting? So wouldn't the temperature have to go to 0 degrees? Go ahead.
Well, if it coexisted, if you've ever seen what's going on, it's kind of spontaneous. There's really very little to no time where it's a mixture of ice and water. It's just kind of another interesting thing would be to figure out exactly what the rate of that crystallization is, because there are videos where, and probably Veritasium has done one or two of them, where you just give it a hard tap on the table and you can actually see that it's gone from a transparent liquid to that kind of translucent milkiness that's ice.
And the whole process seems to take about 1 or 2 seconds.
There's no real time for a thermal equilibration of two phases to be going on.
N2RQ.
Yes, N2RQ.
Good evening. I tuned in while this was an ongoing discussion. My experience with supercooling water and crystallization, I think the way I've tried it or experienced it, already in the liquid water. I don't think you could put it in, except theoretically, but practically, as soon as you would put it in, it upsets the equilibrium, and you would get nucleation. As you point out. But it is very interesting to see how the temperature drops as you go to 0 Celsius and then below before any crystallization takes place. It actually is a dip in the temperature, even with no special apparatus, just having good measurement. I'm not sure if it goes back to Dick or... anyway, my comment.
Hey, thanks a lot. It all is fascinating. Obviously, if you started to stick thermal probes into your super cooled fluid, you would destabilize it and solidify it. So I tend to think it's a little bit of an art form rather than a pure science. That probably they show you the videos where they just pick the right time to take it out of the cooler and smack it. Other times where it didn't quite work out, they don't show us those things. But you can't really put a probe inside some super cooled liquid without expecting it to form completely into a solid block of ice. So, yeah, I agree with you that it would do that, but in every video that I've seen, there's no sign of a probe going on. It's just they show you, they don't even show you the refrigerator, the freezer, what have you. They just show you the glass, and they bang it, and you see the phase change in seconds.
Do I have it?
Yes, you have it if you want it.
Okay, well, we have done labs where we cool the water down by having it soaking, having a tube of water soaking in an ice bath with salt, so that you're getting the temperature a few degrees lower. And we have a temperature probe in the test tube as we lower it, and we can measure the temperature several times per second, and you can see a graph where the temperature actually drops below 0 Celsius and then when the crystallization takes place, it jumps up if it's not fully frozen, it'll jump up to zero, which is usually what we have. I don't know. I haven't done it for a few years, but we used to do that in the lab quite regularly. Back to you.
Lou, what was the lowest temperature you saw before it turned solid? When you were supercooling the water, what's the lowest temperature you remember seeing?
I really don't recall. I'd have to go and look up some of my files.
Very good, Lou. Yeah, I mean the problem is these phase changes are not sharp. There's a little fuzziness on the edges. There's a little bit of energy of activation that requires these phase changes, and so that's why you have these temporary disequilibrium kind of conditions where things are slightly super cool. Usually, though, it's not a large amount. And it equilibrates rather quickly and goes and then seeds from the small sample of ice that develops in normal freezing conditions. But Lou, you sort of brought up a subject that I'm going to touch on my second puzzler for tonight. Okay, my second puzzler for tonight, very, very much apropos to what Lou mentioned. I give you two rather tall glasses of water, same volume. One is regular tap water that you get out of the faucet. The other one has a few teaspoons of salt dissolved in it. Now, they're both the same volume, and they're both the same room temperature. Now, you take two ice cubes. Hopefully, let's assume they're magically identical in volume and dimensions. And of course, temperature. And you drop an ice cube each in one of the two glasses of either water or salty water. So my question, part B tonight, is which do you think one ice cube would melt faster than the other, or they would melt at the same rate? Someone must have some thoughts on the subject. Like I said before, two tall glasses of water, one tap water, the other is rather brackish, salty water. You drop an ice cube into both of them, and you stare at them and wait to see which one dissolves faster. Do they dissolve about the same rate, or is there something else going on?
I'm going to guess that the one in the salt water will dissolve faster, Roy, KTRLAW.
Hey, Dick, that's probably the guess that I would choose as well. Anyone else with any thoughts on the subject?
C2SZE, I would say would melt faster in the salt water as well.
Okay, so everyone's in agreement. Is there any contrarian out there who would like to come up with a different thought on this? Gosh, there's no takers at all. So we got basically two votes for the salt water melting the ice cube faster than the regular water. Again, anyone else with any ideas on this, feel free. We don't take points off or anything. It's a harmless exercise and just kind of understanding stuff.
WS2N.
I would take a chance also.
First Paul, then Lou. So Paul, what do you think?
You go with faster, you know, just like throwing salt down on the ice, you know, on your walkway. Back to you, Roy.
Indeed, that's the way it sounds like. So, I mean, and that's a prescient on Lou's part where he kind of brought up that subject of you can have a bath that's lower than a 0 degrees if you have a salt water solution with ice cubes. So, Lou, what was your thoughts on this?
Well, since you were looking for an alternate idea, my thought is that they start out at the same temperature. If they started out at the same temperature, the question is, where would the heat come from to cause the melting. And if they were at the same temperature, I'm thinking they might go at the same rate. Because you're not throwing salt down. It's already a slightly brackish solution. So I think that's an alternate thought anyway.
Yes, Lou, it's an alternate thought. I'm a little confused, though. The thing that's kind of driving the melting is that you're putting it in a tall glass of room temperature water, be it one being tap water and one being salty water.
Right, if they're the same temperature, it seems to me the amount of heat available would be the same. Because the salty water is not an ice water mixture. If it was an ice water mixture, I would expect it to be at a lower temperature. But you didn't say that. So I'm putting myself up as the contrarian tonight.
Hey, thank you very much, Lou. I appreciate that. Does anyone else have any thoughts? I mean, the only thing not covered yet is the idea that the ice cube in the tap water will melt faster. Anyone want to go with that one?
VDH with a question?
Yes, John.
The previous speaker raised a good question. The amount of heat available to take the tap water down to, let's say, 0 degrees might be more than enough to melt the ice. Which I'm going to assume it is, and I'm going to say they're going to melt at the same rate. Go ahead.
Okay, John, you go along with Lou. That's good. One more last try to see if anyone wants to say that the tap water will melt sooner than the salt water. Okay, well, to me, it wouldn't be a good puzzle if the answer was, in fact, that it is the tap water that melts faster than the salt water. And there's a devious reason for that, and I got it wrong as well, if it makes you feel better, because I sort of thought in the same way that Dick and others thought, that the salt water, you know, if you put salt on ice, it melts faster. So I put two and two together and came up with 22. But in the case of the particular experiment that I mentioned, something very interesting is happening that I didn't keep in mind, and that's how temperature is transmitted. And we've talked about this, and Dick has talked about this, that temperature is transferred from radiation now I'm going to forget all these magical terms. The point is that one of the methods is the flow of hot and cold fluids, convection, conduction, radiation, convection. So you have to think in terms of convection with this. What's really going on in regular water? The ice is slowly melting. The cold ice water is slightly denser than the warmer glass water. It settles down to the bottom, which exposes the ice cube to more of the glass's warm water, and the cycle persists. In the case of the salty water, because the salt is denser than the ice water coming off the ice cube, it tends to kind of stay above at the level of the ice longer than in the tap water bottle glass. So what happens is you have less convection of the room temperature water from the glass circulating up to the ice cube. So effectively, the tap water glass will melt sooner than the salt water. Comments, questions, answers, denials, what have you. I mean, like I said before, I too would get this wrong, because this is a very, very interesting experiment, and I suggest people look at the link and watch the video, because he even injects dye coloring into the water to show the current of water as the ice cubes melt in both of the glasses.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
I think this is the similar effect that they're talking about with climate change, how fresh water infusing into the ocean can affect the salt water circulation of the heavily salted water traveling around along the bottom of the ocean, whereas if fresh water infuses into the ocean, it can disrupt that cycle. Okay.
Well, yes, a different density, although if you give it enough time, it should equilibrate. So that this is a more of a time-sensitive reaction. Eventually, you know, over time, the ice water is definitely going to diffuse despite it having a higher density, because the salt will simply go into solution with the colder ice cube water, and the densities will equilibrate and it will all kind of even out over time. So we're looking at more again of a disequilibrium type of phenomena where given an infinite amount of time, everything evens out. So I don't know if this is going to really impact global climate change quite that much. It certainly is going to have repercussions in the short haul.
Working.
Yes, Lou.
Two things. One is the reference to climate change and the affecting of the circulation of the ocean is an open system. The experimental conditions you described are a closed system. One has to be careful of differentiating those. I also think that this is an experiment that's worth repeating. So if I get the time in the next couple of weeks, I may set that up and try it.
I agree, Lou, that you can't just, take this experiment and base a lot of other things simply upon it. And yes, I think it would be a very nice experiment, certainly to show young people who have learned all about the lowering of freezing points with salt and other such things. And like I said before, if you're so inclined, at roy.ac2gs.com, I'll have a link to the Veritasium video where he does at least two demonstrations of this phenomenon. It's a very well done video.
Okay, very good. I will take a look, but I got to get a few other things out of the way first. Always interesting, Roy, to work you.
Yes, Lou. Yes, Lou, you wanted to say something?
The two of you just doubled, and Lou went out.
And to GGS.
Okay, if you want me to repeat what I said, Roy, I said it's always interesting, and I will take a look. But I got to take care of something else. I'll be in listening mode to our cue.
Hey, Lou, very good. Like I said, the link will be there if you need it. And to GGS, you wanted to say something?
Yes, gentlemen, it's a very interesting conversation. I just got a new BF-F80, the Japanese radio, and I was wondering if I could hit the Weimar repeater. Just to continue the conversation, and thank you for the courtesy. And 2GGS clear.
Okay, very good. Yes, you're getting to the repeater, full quieting. Once again, any questions or other topics that people would like? Otherwise, I will move on to my little collection of stories for tonight.
I thought you had a third puzzle, Roy.
No, Mueller had a third puzzle, but it's a visual puzzle which doesn't really translate well on a radio.
with your ability to describe things, maybe you can get around that.
Okay, I will attempt it, but very poorly. Basically, what he does in the video is he takes a ring that's about, I would say, an inch and a half, 2 inches in diameter. You know, just your usual kind of a loop. It's not a solid object. It's just a metal loop. And he has a chain. And he takes the large metal loop and puts it around the top part of the chain that he's holding. And he drops the looped metal down the chain. So I guess the question would be, what do you think would happen to that ring object by the time it gets to the end of the chain? See, my guess is it would just kind of fall flat at the end of this. You know, it wouldn't do anything. It would just slide down the chain and get to the end of it and then continue to free fall to the ground, and that would be the end of that. But it wouldn't make for a very good video. So something else happened.
Does the ring bounce back and forth off the individual bumps of the chain and go into a kind of an oscillation, slow descent?
No, something else happened. I'll give you that. It rotates more than it spins. See, this is why I wasn't going to use it. What basically happens, if you drop a ring at just the right, if you drop it such that one side you let go a little bit earlier than the second side of the ring, it gives it a little bit of a spin, and it catches the edge of the chain and loops around, and you basically have the ring stuck on a folded over a portion of the chain at the very bottom, and so it hangs off of the end of the chain rather than falling to the ground.
What's magic about the bottom that makes it stop there as opposed to halfway down, Rory?
What's magic, for all intents and purposes, is that there's a lot less inertia in getting that kind of motion at the very edge of the chain than in the middle of the chain. It requires a much greater amount of energy to have half the chain kind of jump up and loop around itself. But towards the end, if you're lucky and you time it right, it doesn't require that much momentum to do that. It's bouncing back and forth anyway, so to bounce up a little bit and kind of clip it and catch the edge of the ring is not a big problem. But as you go higher and higher up the chain, it requires more and more energy to accomplish something like that.
So in every one of his drops, the chain did not fall off, the ring did not fall off the end of the chain?
Well, no. He did it two different ways. He kind of demonstrated the trick. First, he did it the right way to catch it, and you saw the magic. And then he would do it the other way, where he would release both ends of the ring simultaneously in his two fingers, and since it didn't have a little bit of a spin to begin with, it would drop down and completely fall on the floor. Now, like I said before, he's videotaping stuff. I don't know how many takes he decided not to include in this because the trick didn't quite work and he got the timing off or something. So I know that, you know, when he showed it, it worked when he wanted it to, and it didn't work when he didn't want it to.
So this YouTube, Veritasium, is going to be on your list as a place we can go to, is what I think you said, Roy. Go ahead.
Yes, indeed. I will provide a link. You click on that link and it will take you to the YouTube page where he's doing that exact YouTube video. Okay, Any other questions, comments, statements, what have you, before I move on to the stories? Very well. A new study this past week highlights a unique, long-spanning crisis among Americans. For decades, it suggests the United States life expectancy has lagged behind similar countries. And for close to a decade, young to middle-aged Americans have actually been dying more than in previous years, thanks in part to worsening rates of suicide, drug overdoses, and other chronic health problems. Life expectancy at birth is considered an indirect measure of a country's overall health. The higher it is generally, the less people in a country are dying from preventable causes early on in their lives. And it's no secret that the average life expectancy of Americans has gone down in recent years. According to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the life expectancy at birth for someone born in 2017 was 78.6 years. The third straight annual decrease, but the authors of this study published this past Tuesday in the Journal of American Medical Association decided to take a longer look at life expectancy and mortality rates dating back to 1959. Americans, unsurprisingly, they found to have been living longer and longer over the years. In 1959, for example, someone's life expectancy was 69.9 years. But since the 1990s, annual improvements in life expectancy have been slower compared to similar developed countries. By 2010, life expectancy had started to stagnate in the United States until declining post 2014. This lag, this stagnation, and eventual decline in life expectancy, the authors found, can clearly be linked to people between the ages of 25 to 64 dying more often than their counterparts in other countries. And during the years 2010 to 2017, their overall mortality rate actually increased by 6%, an increase that amounted to about 33,000 extra deaths a year. Certain areas of the country have been hit much harder than others. The authors found that about a third of these excess deaths were concentrated in just four states, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and Indiana. Let me drop for a sec. It's supposed to be going down, as it is in other countries, said lead author Stephen Wolf, director emeritus of the Center on Society and Health at Virginia Commonwealth University. The fact that the number is climbing, there's something terribly wrong, he said. This study isn't the first to suggest that increased rates of drug overdose and suicide, which typically affect younger people more, are helping lower United States life expectancy in recent years. But the growing rise in obesity may also be playing a part as well, as more Americans have grown up overweight than ever before. This excess weight in adulthood can then raise the risk of developing high blood pressure, diabetes, and other conditions that could send people to an early grave. The new study seems to lend more credence to a theory voiced by some researchers who have suggested that working-age Americans' growing lack of purpose, loss of community, and financial problems are sending them into despair. But the authors also pointed to things like a weaker yet more expensive health care system and less strict gun control laws and other things as well. Whatever is going on, though, it's evidence that the root cause appears to be going deep. Anyway, let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. We've talked about Earth-based evolutionary forces and how they don't seem to help us develop to be well-suited for zero or microgravity environments. All of you have heard that astronauts' bones tend to get thinned out in space, their muscles atrophy, and even their vision suffers from the exposure of constant low or non-existent gravitational forces. And then there is that additional radiation exposure that they have to tolerate up there. Some may be aware that the lack of significant gravity can also lead to fluid retention in astronauts' lungs, and that fine particulate dust can go much deeper into an astronaut's lung under very low G-forces. And it's much harder for our natural clearing mechanisms to deal with those particulates under microgravity or zero gravity. As if all that wasn't enough, though, now it has emerged that zero or microgravity can make people's blood flow backwards. Recently, the changes to circulation caused by two astronauts to develop small blood clots, which could have been fatal. Fortunately, though, the man and the woman affected came to no harm. The blood changes happened in a vessel called the left internal jugular vein, one of two that normally moves blood out of the head when we're lying down. When we're upright, they mostly collapse to stop too much blood from draining out of our head, with our circulation taking a different route through veins with a little bit more resistance instead. On Earth, people have occasionally been spotted with backward blood flow in the left internal jugular vein if there is a blockage lower down, such as from a tumor growing in their chest. Microgravity is known to change people's blood flow, so Karina Marshall-Goebel of KBR, an engineering procurement and construction company based in Texas, and her colleagues wondered if it would also affect this vein. They carried out measurements and ultrasound scans of the blood vessels in 9 men and 2 women on the ground before and after their mission on the International Space Station. The astronauts took measurements 50 and 150 days into their flight. In 2 of the astronauts, the blood flow was backwards, perhaps because the lack of gravity caused organs in their chest to shift around, pressing on veins lower down, said Marshall Goebel. She adds that this vein is predisposed to be blocked based on where it lies in the body. Let me drop for a second. In another 5 members of the crew, blood in this vein was more or less stagnant. And in one of these, the scan revealed a clot blocked.